was having a splendid time being Senator Harry Truman of the Truman Committee. Yet he acquired no heirs for all this. He was as unpresuming, as accessible as always, despite the extraordinary new power he had in the urgent wartime atmosphere of Washington. Self-importance was on display in the city in many quarters to a greater degree than ever in memory, but Truman seemed somehow unaffected. A reporter for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat described later how he had been sent by his editor to see the senator, who was reportedly back in town briefly after one of his committee forays and staying at the Jefferson Hotel on 16th Street. "I went up to the front desk and asked the room clerk for the number of Senator Truman's room. He gave it to me. I went to a house phone and called the senator's room. The phone was answered not by a security guard, not by an aide, not even by a secretary. It was answered by Harry Truman. I identified myself, and he said, 'Sure, come on up.' I knocked on his door, and the door was opened by Senator Truman. He was alone, in his shirt sleeves, with a book held closed on a finger. He put the book aside, offered me a chair, poured us each a bourbon highball, and sat back with a friendly smile. We talked without interruption for almost an hour. What we talked about, what I later wrote, I have no real recollection of. All I remember is that the book he was reading was Volume 3 of Douglas Southall Freeman's biography of Robert E. Lee, that the bourbon we drank was Old Crow, that he was completely relaxed and responsive, and that there was no one else around." Nearly everything being said about him in the papers was complimentary, and the committee and its work now had the respect of the administration. "I am more surprised every day at the respect with which the special committee is regarded by people in high places," he wrote to Bess, very pleased. "If I can just keep from making any real errors, we are on the way to really help win the war and to make the job more efficient and quicker. That means fewer of our young men killed and a chance for a more honorable settlement. So you must pray for me to go the right way." In the Senate, where he was always well liked, he had achieved a new stature, even among liberals, who until now had regarded him as pleasant enough and conscientious, but bland. "The man from Missouri," remembered Claude Pepper, "had dared to say, 'Show me,' to the powerful military-industrial complex, and he had caught many people in the act." He was notable, too, for so much that he was not. He was not florid or promiscuous. He made no pretense at being superior in any regard. He did not seem to need the limelight, flattery, or a following. He did not want to be the president. To his pleasure, he was recognized now in restaurants and hotel lobbies, as he had never been before except in Missouri, and not always there. "Now you've got to help me more than ever so I won't be a damn fool or stuffed shirt," he told Bess. Margaret, now in her late teens, had begun singing lessons and was doing splendidly, he thought. She was talking already of a singing career. Neither he nor Bess was a singer. Margaret never heard him even try to sing, which seemed odd for someone with such love for music. But he did nothing to discourage her, said only that she must first finish college. He called her Margie or Miss Skinny. Alert and energetic, with a sunny disposition, she was one of the great satisfactions of his life. They so clearly enjoyed one another's company that it gave pleasure to others. One time, one Christmas, remembered a niece of Ethel Noland's who lived in the Noland house on North Delaware, Margaret was with him, and they came across for a little visit Christmas morning. "And I don't think I ever laughed any harder. They just gave it back and forth. They were as fun as can be. Repartee? He was so crazy about Margaret, just enjoyed being with her and talking with her, and We sat there just entranced. With friends in Washington, he could talk about her by the hour, as she knew. You have a good mind, a beautiful physique, and a possible successful future outlook, but that now is up to you, he wrote when she turned 18. You are the mistress of your future. All your mother and dad can do is to look on, advise when asked, and hope and wish you a happy one. There'll be troubles and sorrow aplenty, but there'll also be happy days and hard work. From a financial standpoint, your father has not been a shining success, but he has tried to leave you something that, as Mr. Shakespeare says, cannot be stolen, an honorable reputation and a good name. You must continue that heritage and see that it is not spoiled. You're all we have, and we both count on you. Later, to Bess, he would write, Tell my baby she has a most beautiful voice. To keep it natural, without any gimcracks, pronounce her words clearly and in English so they can be understood, and she'll be a great singer. She, too, must never become a damned fool or a stuffed shirt. They remained an extremely close-knit family, their social schedule modest, their way of life private and quiet. At home in the small, simply furnished apartment on Connecticut, Truman's corner of the living room included a chintz-covered armchair, a reading lamp, his phonograph, and his record collection. In a small, freestanding bookcase within arm's reach was a leather-bound set of Plutarch's Lives, a two-volume Andrew Jackson by Marquis James, all four volumes of Freeman's Lee, the Bible, Stories of the Great Operas, a biography of John Nance Garner, and Don Quixote. Bess, now in her 50s, looked plumper and more matronly by the year and was enjoying Washington as she never had. The stepped-up pace of wartime agreed with her. He had put her on the office payroll, a not uncommon practice, but one he had criticized others for, most notably Tuck Milligan during his first Senate race. Her salary was $2,400. Truman worried about damaging publicity if ever this were known, but the extra income made a difference. How much real work she did would remain a matter of opinion among the staff, none of whom were as well paid. At one point, he advised her privately to only just drop in and do some signing of letters. It helps all concerned. She was working also at the USO one day a week and reportedly reveled in the excitement he was causing on the Hill. In a letter from Independence during a visit in June of 1942, she told him how much better he was sounding on the radio. A speech explaining the rubber shortage had been broadcast nationwide. She thought it his best yet, and Ethel Noland agreed. His consonants had all been pronounced just right, Ethel said. The day before their 23rd wedding anniversary, he sent Bess 23 roses, then telephoned her that night and wrote a letter the next morning. Washington, D.C., June 28, 1942. Dear Bess, well, this is the day. Lots of water has gone over the dam. There have been some terrible days and many more nice ones. When my store went fluey and cost my friends and Frank Wallace money, when Margie came, don't think I ever spent such a day, although the pains were yours. And to name one more, when we thought Stark had won and when I lost actually for Eastern Judge. But the winds have far outweighed them. June 28, 1919 was the happiest day of my life, for I had looked forward to it for a lifetime nearly, or so it seemed. When a man gets the right kind of wife, his career is made, and I got just that. The greatest thing we have is a real young lady who hasn't an equal anywhere. That's all the excuse we need for living, and not much else matters. It was grand to say hello last night. I was so tired I could hardly sit up. Went to bed right away after playing Margie's song record and the Minuet in G and Chopin waltzes. It's pretty lonesome around here without you. Kiss Margie. Lots and lots of love and happy returns. Harry. In November 1942, after the American landing in North Africa, he was praised in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in a way that would have been inconceivable a few years before. Harry Truman, wrote Marquis Childs, had become one of the most useful and at the same time one of the most forthright and fearless of the 96 in the Senate. In a book published that same fall, a brilliant portrait of Washington going to war called I Write from Washington, Childs also contrasted the appalling revelations of the Truman Committee to the kind of false picture presented by the Office of Facts and Figures, a new propaganda agency. Truman and his committee were now known nationwide, observed the Washington Star. So great was their reputation, said Businessweek, that often a threat to take everything to the Truman Committee is sufficient to force a cure of abuses. The whole country was greatly indebted to Senator Truman and his colleagues, wrote The Nation. Arthur Crock of the New York Times so admired the senator's objectivity at the total expense of partisanship in his running of the committee that he invited a select few of his fellow journalists to lunch with Senator Truman at the renowned Metropolitan Club, and wrote later of the excellent impression he made. By 1943, the committee had produced 21 reports covering a wide range of subjects: gasoline rationing, lumber, farm machinery, the loss of American shipping to U-boats. The week of March 8, 1943, Investigator Truman was on the cover of Time. In many ways, said Time, the Truman Committee was among the outstanding successes of the entire war effort. It was the watchdog, spotlight, conscience, and spark plug to the economic war behind the lines, and a heartening sign that even in wartime, a democracy could keep an eye on itself. Hardly less remarkable, said the magazine, was the transformation of Harry Truman, from Pendergast errand boy to able, energetic committee chairman just when he was needed. For a congressional committee to be considered the first line of defense, especially in a nation which does not tend to admire its representatives in Congress assembled, is encouraging to believers in democracy. So is the sudden emergence of Harry Truman, whose presence in the Senate is a queer accident of democracy. Truman himself, wrote Time, was scrupulously honest. His only vices are small-stakes poker and occasional drink of bourbon. What do they mean, an occasional drink of bourbon? Louis Schwellenbach cabled from Spokane. In a poll of Washington correspondents conducted by Look magazine, Senator Truman would be named one of the 10 men in Washington whose services had been the most important to the war effort. Further, he was the only one on the list from either branch of Congress. On April 14, 1943, putting aside his committee work, Truman flew to Chicago to champion a cause that had little to do with the war effort and that seemed a bit surprising for a Midwestern senator, a Baptist, a Mason, and proud member of the American Legion to involve himself with. He spoke at a huge rally called to urge help for the doomed Jews of Europe. Chicago Stadium was packed, the crowd estimated at 25,000. The chairman was a prominent Roman Catholic, Federal Judge William J. Campbell. The keynote speaker was Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York, head of the American Jewish Congress. The war in which he and his comrades fought 23 years earlier, said Senator Truman in his speech, had been waged not only that nations might be free, but also that the people who make up those nations might be free. Now, that freedom had been trampled to dust under the iron heel of the barbarian. The Jews of Europe, through the edict of a mad Hitler, were being herded like animals into concentration camps. It was time something was done about it. In private, Truman was a man who still, out of old habits of the mouth, could use a word like kike, or, in a letter to his wife, dismiss Miami as nothing but hotels, filling stations, Hebrews, and cabins. But he spoke now from the heart, and with passing reference to Roosevelt's four freedoms, made an implied criticism of the president for doing too little to help the Jews. Truman was not among those who refused to believe the Germans capable of such atrocities as were being reported from Europe. Merely talking about the four freedoms is not enough. This is the time for action. No one can any longer doubt the horrible intentions of the Nazi beasts. We know that they plan the systematic slaughter throughout all of Europe, not only of the Jews, but of vast numbers of other innocent peoples. Now was the time for fighting, he continued. But no less important was planning for the day when the war would end. Today, not tomorrow, we must do all that is humanly possible to provide a haven and a place of safety for all those who can be grasped from the hands of the Nazi butchers. Free lands must be opened to them, he said. Their present oppressors must know that they will be held directly accountable for their bloody deeds. To do all this, we must draw deeply on our traditions of aid to the oppressed, and on our great national generosity. This is not a Jewish problem. It is an American problem, and we must and we will face it squarely and honorably. It was a remarkable speech, one of the strongest he ever made. How very important it was that he felt as he did, neither he nor any of his audience could possibly yet know. With other senators on the committee, Hatch, Ball, Harold Burton, Truman was giving more and more thought to problems of the post-war world. And though he played no direct part in the drafting of a Senate resolution for the establishment of a post-war international organization, a United Nations, a resolution sponsored by Senators Ball, Burton, Hatch, and Lister Hill, and hence known as B-square-H-square, Truman was the acknowledged guiding spirit. The United States could not possibly avoid the assumption of world leadership after this war, he was quoted in the New York Times. And with Republican Congressman Walter Judd of Minnesota, who had also fought in World War I, Truman set out on a Midwest speaking tour in the summer of 1943 to spread the internationalist word under the sponsorship of the United Nations Association. He kept hammering at the same themes over and over across Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri. History has bestowed on us a solemn responsibility. We failed before to give a genuine peace. We dare not fail this time. We must not repeat the blunders of the past. Not all the Truman Committee's efforts were successful. The Cannell Project went on, and wound up costing $134 million. All money that need never have been spent, and more serious even than the financial waste, was the misuse of vitally needed manpower and materials. At one point, 4,000 troops and 12,000 civilians were involved. Corporations and government agencies found to be bungling things, or committing outright fraud like Carnegie Illinois Steel, were frequently let off the hook to keep production rolling. We want aluminum, not excuses, Truman said after the committee's tangle with Alcoa. Yet, overall, the committee's performance was outstanding. It would be called the most successful congressional investigative effort in American history. Later estimates were that the Truman Committee saved the country as much as $15 billion. This was almost certainly an exaggeration. No exact figure is possible. But the sum was enormous and unprecedented. And whatever the amount, it was only part of the service rendered. The most important power of the committee was its deterrent effect. Fear of investigation or public exposure by the committee was enough in itself to cause countless people in industry, government, and the military to do their jobs right, thereby, in the long run, saving thousands of lives. It was not just that the production of defective airplane engines or low-grade steel had been exposed. The committee also made positive contributions to the production of improved military equipment. The most notable, and one that saved many lives, was the famous hinge-prowed Higgins landing craft used for amphibious assault, which was built and ordered by the Navy's Bureau of Ships only after heavy prodding from the committee. With the new Higgins craft, troops could be landed on a variety of shallow beaches rather than just established harbors. It increased mobility for the offense, made obsolete much of the old coastal defenses. Yet, until the committee looked at the subject with a fresh eye, Navy bureaucrats had been trying to force the adoption of a plainly inferior design. The committee was also a continuing source of information about the war effort for the whole country. In its report on the loss to U-boats, for example, the committee said 12 million tons of American shipping were destroyed in 1942, an alarming figure. This was 1 million tons more than all the nation's shipyards were then producing. The Navy immediately denied the validity of the report. But when Secretary of the Navy Knox appeared before the committee in executive session, he admitted the committee was telling the truth. Unquestionably, the relentless watchdog role, the attention to detail during the hearings, the quality as well as the quantity of the reports issued, all greatly increased public confidence in how the war was being run. Further, anyone called before the committee could count on a fair hearing. The chairman would have it no other way. From what he had observed of Chairman Truman during the day of General Sommervell's testimony, Alan Drury of United Press recorded, "He seems to be a generally good man, probably deserving of his reputation." But after watching several more sessions, including one in which Truman went out of his way to keep some of the other senators from browbeating a witness, Drury could hardly say enough for the head of the committee. "There are a number of times when it is quite easy to find oneself thanking whatever powers there be that the country has Harry Truman in the Senate. He is an excellent man, a fine senator, and sound American. The debt the public owes him is great indeed. And Boss Pendergast put him in. Politics is funny business." Section 3. For quite some time, staff investigators had been picking up puzzling hints of a secret enterprise larger even than the Cannell Project. Odd bits and pieces of information indicating huge unexplained expenditures for something identified only as the Manhattan Project. On June 17, 1943, Truman telephoned Secretary of War Stimson. Their conversation was brief. Stimson: "Now, that is a matter which I know all about personally, and I am the only one of the group of two or three men in the whole world who know about it." Truman: "I see." Stimson: "It's part of a very important secret development." Truman: "Well, all right then." Stimson: "And I..." Truman: "I herewith see the situation, Mr. Secretary, and you won't have to say another word to me. Whenever you say that to me, that's all I want to hear." Stimson: "All right." Truman: "You assure that this is for a specific purpose and you think it's all right? That's all I need to know." Stimson: "Not only for a specific purpose, but a unique purpose." Truman: All right, then. Stimson, thank you very much. Apparently, however, more information kept coming to Truman in one way or other, and by July he had been told enough to know the essential nature of the very important secret development. Incredibly, he even put it in a letter to Louis Schwellenbach, who had since left the Senate to become a federal district judge in Spokane. Schwellenbach had been concerned over sudden, enormous land condemnations for the DuPont Company along the Columbia River near a desolate railroad town called Hanford. Nearly 500,000 acres were involved, and he had written to Truman to inquire about it. On July 15, 1943, Truman wrote to say he shouldn't worry. "I know something about that tremendous real estate deal," he said, "and I have been informed that it is for the construction of a plant to make a terrific explosion for a secret weapon that will be a wonder." He added, "I hope it works." This was a terrible breach of security on Truman's part, an astonishing lapse of simple good judgment. To have passed on such information in so offhand a fashion in an ordinary letter sent through the mail. It was exactly the sort of insider talk, one member of the senatorial club to another, that gave generals and admirals nightmares, and little desire ever to tell politicians anything more than necessary. Truman had not bothered even to write in private, but dictated the letter to Mildred Dryden, which means that as of then, she too was aware of the making of a terrific explosion. But apparently, no one ever found out about the letter. Neither Schwellenbach nor Dryden said a word more on the subject as far as is known. Curiosity and concern over the DuPont operations at Hanford did not end there. Senator Elbert Thomas of Oklahoma wanted the situation investigated. He, too, apparently, had been hearing stories. A staff man on the Truman Committee informed the chairman confidentially that complaints of waste and inefficiency at Hanford had become chronic, and added, "In my humble opinion, I believe that this is another canal, wherein the guise of secrecy is being resorted to by the War Department to cover what may be another shocking example when the lid is finally taken off." Truman felt pressured to know more, his agreement with Stimson notwithstanding. On November 30, 1943, he informed Senator Thomas, "I have sent an investigator to look into it, and I hope we can find out what is wrong." A few weeks afterward, Fred Canfield walked into a Western Union office in Walla Walla, Washington, and sent the following telegram, collect, to Senator Truman. It must have made interesting reading to whoever put it on the wire. "Colonel Mathias, commanding officer, DuPont plant, told me that you and the Secretary of War had an understanding that none of your committee would come into the plant. Through another agency, I found that within the last 10 days a confidential letter was received from the War Department to Army officers and to high civilian engineers to the effect that these people were to see that no senator or anyone connected with the Senate was to be given any information about the project." Canfield, who may not have known as much as Truman about the purpose of the plant, was only doing his duty. Truman thought him overly efficient. "Whenever he finds out that I want something," he once said of Canfield, "he never stops until it is done." But after the wire from Walla Walla, committee interest in the Manhattan Project cooled. The understanding with Stimson was honored again. Nor is there anything in the record to suggest that Truman ever heard of separating plutonium from U-238, the work going on at Hanford, or had any idea how the terrific explosion was to be made. Only a few months later, Stimson, General Marshall, and Vannevar Bush, head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, drove to the Capitol for a private meeting in Speaker Sam Rayburn's office. Present besides Rayburn were the House Majority and Minority Leaders, John McCormick and Joe Martin. It was then, in February 1944, that Stimson and Marshall revealed the greatest secret of the war for the first and only time on the Hill. As Joe Martin wrote years later, "The United States was engaged in a crash program to develop the atomic bomb before the Germans perfected one. Marshall described the design of the bomb in some technical detail. Stimson said that if the Germans got this weapon first, they might win the war overnight. They told us that they would need an additional $1,600,000,000 to manufacture the bomb. Because of an overriding necessity for secrecy, they made the unique request that the money be provided without a trace of evidence to show how it was spent." The three legislators agreed to do what was necessary. Senator Truman was told nothing. Yet, according to Stimson's diary, the chairman of the investigating committee was soon after him once more. Truman was now asking that a member of the committee staff, General Frank Lowe, be taken into Stimson's confidence about the Hanford Works. Stimson by now was extremely annoyed with Senator Truman. Stimson thought he had an agreement. He told Truman no, a response Truman did not take lightly. "He threatened me with dire consequences. I told him I had to do just what I did," said Stimson in his diary, adding, "Truman is a nuisance and a pretty untrustworthy man. He talks smoothly, but he acts meanly." Under no circumstances was Senator Truman to be told anything more. Chapter 8. Numbered Days. Franklin Roosevelt.
"I hardly know Truman." July 1944.
Section 1. It was in early summer of 1943, 1 year in advance of the Democratic National Convention, that Senator Truman recorded on paper for the first time that in some circles he was being talked of as a candidate for vice president, assuming the president were to run for a fourth term. He had been invited to Sunday lunch at the Washington home of Senator Joe Guffey, a staunch New Dealer who took him out into the garden to ask, very confidentially, what he thought of Vice President Henry Wallace. Truman had smiled and said Wallace was the best Secretary of Agriculture the country ever had. Guffey, laughing, said that was what he thought, too. Then he wanted to know if I would help out the ticket if it became necessary by accepting the nomination for vice president, Truman recorded. I told him in words of one syllable that I would not. And though the idea was talked about with increasing frequency thereafter, Truman, when asked his opinion, always gave the same answer. He wanted to stay in the Senate. Moreover, he believed in being realistic. Franklin Roosevelt had shown no sign of dissatisfaction with the vice president, nor any inclination to abandon him. And even if Roosevelt were to change his mind, there were a number of others, Jimmy Burns and Alban Barkley, to name the two most obvious possibilities, who were better known, more experienced, and who would leap to the opportunity. Jimmy Burns, a small, tidy, vivid man whom Truman greatly admired, was a Southerner, a lapsed Catholic, and 64 years old, all of which could count against him. But he had done virtually everything there was to do in government, his experience ranging across all three branches, beginning with 7 terms in the House before going to the Senate. Named to the Supreme Court in 1941, Burns had resigned after only 1 term to become Roosevelt's War Mobilization Director, with an office in the East Wing of the White House. Popularly referred to as Assistant President, he was the consummate insider, whose political judgment, whose ability to funnel money where needed in the party, such as to Senator Truman in 1940, were thought second to none. Roosevelt relied heavily on him and liked him. By contrast to such a man as Burns, Truman was small potatoes, as he well knew, and no closer to Roosevelt now than he had ever been. In fact, lately a distinct chill had been felt at the White House concerning Truman. Ever since publication in American Magazine of a ghost-written article about the findings of the committee that Truman had allowed to be published under his name without bothering to read it very carefully. Too late had he discovered how critical it was of the administration's handling of the war effort. "Leadership is what we Americans are crying for," the article said. "We are fighting mad and ready to tackle any job and to make any sacrifice. All we ask is that we be intelligently and resolutely led." He was certain that the president didn't like him, Truman told friends in the Senate. Still, the vice presidential speculation continued, and with Truman's name spoken often, for the reason that certain influential figures in the Democratic Party had joined in a pact to keep Henry Wallace off the ticket. They were only a handful, only a half dozen or so to begin with, but they were among the most powerful men in the party, and they had taken it upon themselves to talk down Wallace at every opportunity and begin organizing wider opposition to him. They included the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Frank Walker, who had replaced Jim Farley as Postmaster General, Ed Pauley, a wealthy California oil man who was treasurer of the National Committee, George E. Allen, a jovial man about Washington, lobbyist and secretary of the National Committee, and Robert E. Hannigan, Truman's last-minute savior in the 1940 campaign, who had since advanced to Commissioner of Internal Revenue and was now not only a great favorite of the president's, but in line to replace Walker as national chairman. General Edwin Pa Watson, appointment secretary at the White House, had also agreed to clear the way whenever possible for anti-Wallace Democrats to see the president. Watson, it was hoped, could serve as counterbalance to Mrs. Roosevelt, a known champion of the vice president. But the key man in the conspiracy was Edward Joseph Flynn of the Bronx, who, since the downfall of Tom Pendergast, was considered the most powerful political boss in the country, and who in looks and manner bore little resemblance to the usual picture of a successful Irish politician. At 52, Flynn was tall and handsome, with thinning gray hair and gray eyes, beautifully dressed, well-educated, an ardent gardener, a student of history. Most importantly, he was a devoted friend of Franklin Roosevelt, and his influence on Roosevelt on political matters exceeded that of anyone inside or out of the administration. It was Ed Flynn who ran the president's successful bid for a third term in 1940. And it was Ed Flynn now, more than any of the others, who saw defeat in November unless something was done about the vice president. For Henry Wallace was not their idea of a politician. Henry Wallace was one of the most serious-minded, fascinating figures in national public life, a plant geneticist by profession, who had done important work in the development of hybrid corn, and whose pioneer hybrid corn company was a multi-million-dollar enterprise. He was an author, lecturer, social thinker, a firm advocate for civil rights, and thorough New Dealer with a large devoted following. With the exception of Franklin Roosevelt, he was the most popular Democrat in the country. Those who loved him saw him as one of the rare men of ideas in politics and the prophet of a truly democratic America. But he was also an easy man to make fun of, and to these tough party professionals, Wallace seemed to have his head in the clouds. They had never wanted him for vice president. He had been forced upon them in 1940, when Roosevelt threatened not to run again unless he could have Wallace as his running mate. Wallace was too intellectual, a mystic who spoke Russian and played with a boomerang and reputedly consulted with the spirit of a dead Sioux Indian chief. As vice president, he seemed pathetically out of place and painfully lacking in political talent or even a serious interest in politics. When not presiding over the Senate, he would often shut himself in his office and study Spanish. He was too remote, too controversial, too liberal, much too liberal, which was the main charge against him. Of the group, only Ed Flynn appears to have personally admired Wallace and his ideas, but as the political writer Richard Rovere observed of Flynn, he considered candidates only as good as their chances of winning. None of this would have mattered greatly had the president said Wallace was again his choice. But Roosevelt preferred to let things slide. His mind was on the war. He was also just as happy to keep everyone guessing as long as possible. The first meeting with Roosevelt to discuss the advisability of ditching Wallace took place at the White House in January 1944, 6 months in advance of the National Convention, and Truman's name figured prominently in a discussion of alternative choices that included Burns, Barclay, Sam Rayburn, Ambassador John G. Wynant, Senator Sherman Minton, and Justice William O. Douglas, who had replaced the late Louis D. Brandeis on the Supreme Court. It was Hannigan who had the most to say about Truman, but Hannigan appeared equally enthusiastic about Burns, and as a whole, the group was more against Wallace than for any one possible replacement. Roosevelt declined to give a clear sign of what he wanted. As the historian James McGregor Burns, then a member of the White House staff, later wrote, Roosevelt never pursued a more Byzantine course than in his handling of this question. Truman, who was party to none of the discussions, thought Sam Rayburn would be the best nominee and said so publicly. By spring, Jimmy Burns looked like the clear favorite at the White House, though Wallace was leading in the polls. Harry Hopkins, the only one closer to Roosevelt than Burns, made a point of telling Burns that Roosevelt very much hoped he would be on the ticket. Flying home from the Tehran conference looking out at the stars, Hopkins had asked the president who he thought would be the best man to take over his duties if something happened to the plane and it went down. Jimmy Burns, Roosevelt said without hesitation. When Burns appeared reluctant to try for the job, others began putting pressure on him. For by then, there was concern over more than just losing votes in November. The president's declining health could no longer be ignored, though in wartime nothing on the matter could be said publicly. After a bout of so-called walking pneumonia in April, Roosevelt, with much wartime secrecy, went to Bernard Baruch's estate in South Carolina for what was supposed to have been a 2-week rest, but that stretched to a month. Seeing the president after his return to the White House, Ed Flynn was so alarmed by his appearance that he urged Mrs. Roosevelt to use her influence to keep him from running again. I felt, Flynn later said, that he would never survive his term. Ed Pauley would say that his own determination to unseat Wallace came strictly from the conviction that Wallace was not a fit man to be president, and by my belief, on the basis of continuing observation, that President Roosevelt would not live much longer. George Allen, remembering these critical months just before the 1944 convention, wrote that every one of their group realized that the man nominated to run with Roosevelt would, in all probability, be the next president. The worry aroused by the president's appearance was more than justified. His condition was worse than all but a very few were aware of. Secretly, he was under the constant supervision of a cardiologist, who, after a thorough examination in March, reported that, given proper care, he might live a year. In May, Roosevelt sent Henry Wallace on a mission to China, which many took as a sign that Wallace was finished. Then, in early June, just after news of the Allied landings at Normandy, and with only a month to go before the convention, Hannegan dropped in on Burns at the White House, where for several hours he tried to convince Burns to become a candidate for vice president. The president himself, Hannegan said, had told him Burns was the man he had really wanted as his running mate in 1940, and that he would rather have Burns on the ticket this time than anybody. Later, Pa Watson telephoned Burns to confirm everything Hannegan had said. On June 27th, Hannegan took things a step further. He told Roosevelt that Wallace had to come off the ticket. All he had to do, Hannegan said to the president, was to agree to Jimmy Burns, and they could sail through the convention and the election. "That suits me fine," Roosevelt responded. "He was my candidate for vice president 4 years ago at the 1940 convention, but religion got messed up in it." "That won't matter a damn bit," Hannegan answered. "I am a Catholic, and I can talk on that subject." While Truman had been a great backer of Hannegan ever since the 1940 Senate race, it was Burns, with his influence with Roosevelt, who had had the most say in making Hannegan Commissioner of Internal Revenue and now the new chairman of the Democratic Party. Roosevelt asked Burns to go with him to Shangri-La, the presidential retreat in the Catoctin Mountains of Maryland, to talk campaign strategy for a few days, after which, wrote Burns, "I did conclude that he was sincere in wanting me for his running mate." Yet, at the time, at the end of a long day, Burns also remarked to one of his aides, "Now, partner, let's not get too excited on this vice president business. I know that man FDR more than anybody else." Asked by two or three of his staff who were gathered about his desk what he thought of Harry Truman, Roosevelt said he didn't know much about him. But Henry J. Kaiser, the famous shipbuilder, he said, was somebody else we have got up our sleeve. Having completed a cross-country survey at Roosevelt's request, Ed Flynn told him that opposition to Wallace was greater even than anyone supposed. Both Flynn and Roosevelt knew the election in the fall would be close, that Roosevelt was by no means a certain winner. Wallace on the ticket, Flynn warned, could mean the loss of New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and California, which was undoubtedly an exaggeration. The problem was to find someone who would hurt Roosevelt's chances least. So together, according to Flynn's subsequent account, the two of them ran down the list, weighing the negative sides of all the other candidates. Burns was the strongest choice, Flynn agreed, but Burns, who had been raised a Catholic, had left the church when he married to become an Episcopalian. And in Flynn's view, the Catholics wouldn't stand for that. Organized labor had no enthusiasm for Burns since he had opposed sit-down strikes in wartime. But far more serious to Flynn was Burns's Southern background and recorded positions on racial issues. This was the crucial flaw. In 1938, Burns had been in the forefront of those Southern senators fighting against a proposed federal anti-lynching law. And in a speech on the Senate floor, he had turned much of his fire on Walter White, head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. "The Negro has not only come into the Democratic Party," Burns had said, "but the Negro has come into control of the Democratic Party." Then,
Pointing to the gallery where White was sitting, Burns exclaimed, "If Walter White should consent to have this bill laid aside, its advocates would desert it as quickly as football players unscramble when the whistle of the referee is heard." When asked who he thought should run with Roosevelt, Burns usually mentioned Truman, Rayburn, and Henry J. Kaiser. Sam Rayburn was a good man, Flynn and Roosevelt agreed. But Rayburn was from Texas, another Southerner, and so couldn't be considered. When they went through the list of the entire Senate, only one fitted the picture, Harry Truman. As Flynn wrote, "His record as head of the Senate committee was excellent. His labor votes in the Senate were good. On the other hand, he seemed to represent to some degree the conservatives in the party. He came from a border state, and he had never made any racial remarks. He just dropped into the slot." Flynn left the White House convinced he had an agreement, that Roosevelt saw Truman as the one who would do the ticket the least harm. This was not exactly a rousing endorsement for the senator from Missouri, but it was what Flynn had wanted to hear, which is probably the main reason Roosevelt, given his manner of operation, sent him on his way with that impression. About this same time, Roosevelt asked a favor of Mrs. Anna Rosenberg, a member of the War Mobilization Advisory Board, whose office, like that of Burns, was in the East Wing. Mrs. Rosenberg had become a favorite of the president's. A highly attractive woman, she dressed smartly, wore expensive perfume, and lent an air of femininity to the White House that he greatly welcomed. In contrast to Mrs. Roosevelt, she also appreciated good food and would, on occasion, smuggle in jars of caviar to the president, sometimes also baskets of paprika chicken cooked by her Hungarian mother, which she and Roosevelt would happily devour together in his office in secret, like naughty children, she would remember. Roosevelt told her now that Burns was the best man, but asked her to go tell Burns he was not to be the vice presidential choice because of the Negro vote. Mrs. Rosenberg, who admired Burns greatly and wanted him on the ticket, said she couldn't do that. If the president wanted Burns to know he had no chance, then the president would have to tell him himself, she said. But Roosevelt never did, never could, as she knew. Truman was trying to clear up his work and get away for a few days in Missouri before the convention opened in Chicago on July 19th. With so little time remaining, gossip over the vice presidential question had become intense. To any and all who asked if he was interested in the nomination, Truman said no. No, no, no. The whole matter was getting on his nerves. He had not seen the president. It had been more than a year since he had seen the president. Nor would he make any effort to do so now. "I don't want to be vice president," he told William Helm as they were rushing along a hall in the Senate office building, and, as Helm wrote later, anyone who saw the look on his face would have known he meant it. The number of other Democrats in the Senate, reputedly in the running, had grown to such a list, reporters were joking, that it was easier to tally those who were not candidates. On July 6th, to judge by corridor gossip, Wallace had the nomination sewed up. On July 7th, the word from informed sources was that the president wanted Wallace, but he also wanted three or four acceptable names held in reserve should the convention refuse to swallow Henry. In that case, Barkley was first choice. On July 9th, it was noted that Senator Truman, by continuing to do battle with the War Production Board and the Armed Services, was killing whatever chance he might have had. "The vice president simply presides over the Senate and sits around hoping for a funeral," Truman explained to a friend. "It is a very high office, which consists entirely of honor, and I don't have any ambition to hold an office like that." Max Lowenthal and Les Biffle were after him to run for vice president. "The madam doesn't want me to do it," he told Lowenthal. To Margaret, he wrote, "It's funny how some people would give a fortune to be as close as I am to it, and I don't want it." Then, making it unmistakable that his thoughts, too, were on the obvious mortality of Franklin Roosevelt, not to say his own advancing years, he added, 1600 Pennsylvania is a nice address, but I'd rather not move in through the back door, or any other door at 60. The letter was written on July 9th, just as he started the long drive home alone to Missouri. On Monday, July 10th, after an all-night flight from Seattle, an exhausted Vice President of the United States arrived in Washington at the end of a 51-day, 27,000-mile mission to China. And at 4:30 that afternoon, he met with the President to report on what he had seen. Roosevelt was cordial, as always. For a long while, they talked about China and Wallace's venture to Outer Mongolia, where no American had set foot in 17 years. Wallace had brought Roosevelt some Mongolian stamps for his collection. As Wallace recorded in his diary, it was Roosevelt who at last opened up on politics, saying that when I went out I should say that no politics were discussed. Roosevelt assured Wallace that he was his choice as running mate, and that he intended the fourth term to be really progressive. He talked of the professional politicians who thought Wallace might mean a loss of 2 or 3 million votes, figures Ed Flynn had supplied. "Mr. President," Wallace interjected, "if you can find anyone who will add more strength to the ticket than I, by all means take him." Roosevelt warned Wallace of the ordeal he might face at Chicago trying to get the vice presidential nomination, and expressed concern about the pain this could mean for Wallace's family. "Think of the catcalls and jeers and the definiteness of rejection," Roosevelt remarked. Wallace said he was not worried about his family. The next day, Tuesday, July 11th, the president announced formally that he was running for another term. Young Alan Drury wrote that he would never forget the look on the faces of Democratic senators when the news reached the Hill. "It was as though the sun had burst from the clouds and glory surrounded the world. Relief, and I mean relief, was written on every face. The meal ticket was still the meal ticket, and all was well with the party." At lunch that day, July 11th, Hopkins again asked Roosevelt who he thought would make the best president, Burns or William O. Douglas. "Jimmy Burns," Roosevelt said, "because he knows more about government than anybody around." Hopkins asked who the president thought would win the nomination if the convention were left free to decide. "Burns," Roosevelt said again. Then that night following dinner, in the president's blue oval study on the second floor of the White House, the full anti-Wallace coalition, Flynn, Hannigan, Walker, Allen, Pauley, plus one more exceptionally influential practical politician, Mayor Ed Kelly of Chicago, gathered with the president for what they were to regard as the decisive meeting. Because of the muggy heat, everyone was in shirt sleeves. Drinks were passed, and again the full list of vice presidential possibilities was taken up one by one. Again, Burns and Rayburn were rejected. Now, for the first time, Barclay, too, was ruled out, and by Roosevelt, because Barclay was too old. Like Burns, Barclay was 66, which made him Roosevelt senior by only 4 years, but the Republicans at their convention in Chicago had just nominated for president Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York, who was all of 42, the age Roosevelt's Republican cousin Theodore had been when he took office, and so age could very likely be an issue in the campaign. Roosevelt thought a young man was needed on the Democratic ticket, and to the surprise of the others, he proposed William O. Douglas, an idea none of them had ever seriously entertained. Douglas, he said, was youthful, he was 46, dynamic, a good liberal, and he had a kind of Boy Scout quality that would appeal to voters. Besides, Roosevelt thought, Douglas played an interesting game of poker. But the idea fell flat. No one wanted Douglas any more than Wallace. Again, the talk turned to Harry Truman. Roosevelt contributing little to the conversation, except to observe that he had set Truman up in his committee, which was not so, and thought he was doing a commendable job. Truman was able and loyal to the administration, Roosevelt agreed, and wise to the way of politics. Reportedly, the question of Truman's association with the Pendergast machine was thoroughly discussed and dismissed as irrelevant. One point only troubled the president: Truman's age. He wasn't sure, Roosevelt said, but he thought Truman was nearly 60. Hannigan, who knew Truman was already 60, tried to change the subject, but Roosevelt sent for a congressional directory and the conversation continued. When the directory arrived, Ed Polly quietly took it and said no more. As to which candidate might be best suited and prepared for the burdens and responsibilities of the presidency, there appears to have been little or no discussion. Apparently, only Roosevelt touched on the subject, saying again that, all in all, Jimmy Burns was the best qualified man. It would also be remembered how tired and listless the president was all through the stifling hot evening. Frank Walker commented later that he had never known Roosevelt to stand so willingly on the sidelines and let others carry the ball. Exhausted he was, and preoccupied by the war. Since the Allied landings at Normandy on June 6th, the Germans had launched their first V-1 buzz bombs, Hitler's terrifying Vergeltungswaffe, the vengeance weapon against London. In the Pacific, the American assault on the island of Saipan had been met with Japanese resistance as fierce as any since the fighting began. Just the week before, on the night of July 6th, 3,000 Japanese had hurled themselves against the 27th Division in one mass banzai charge, all to be killed. No one, and least of all Roosevelt, expected the final stages of the war to become anything but more and more costly. At last, turning to Hannigan, Roosevelt said, "Bob, I think you and everyone else here want Truman." Roosevelt had not said yet whether he himself wanted Truman, but at this point Ed Polly, still holding the congressional directory, rose and suggested they break up, then hurried everybody out of the room before Roosevelt had a chance to say anything more. Downstairs, as they were about to leave, Hannigan decided to go back up and get something in writing. By several accounts, he returned with a note that Roosevelt had scrawled on an envelope. "Bob, I think Truman is the right man, FDR." But an offhand personal note was hardly conclusive. And as George Allen observed in Understatement, Roosevelt was still free to change his mind. A day or so later, writing in his diary, Harold Ickes, the Secretary of Interior, recorded that in a conversation with the president about the vice presidential issue, little had been said about Senator Truman. "I gathered that he felt as I do," wrote Ickes, "that Truman might do, but that he might raise a political boss issue that would be especially welcomed by Dewey, whose rise to political prominence has been due to fighting political bosses." It was a pattern. No matter how many talked to Roosevelt on the subject, each and all came away feeling he thought just as they did. For the moment, anyway. At first chance the morning of Wednesday, July 12th, Hannigan went to see Henry Wallace at his apartment at the Wardman Park, a mission undertaken, according to Hannigan's later account, at the request of the president. He told Wallace he would be a detriment to the ticket and must therefore withdraw. Wallace said they might as well understand one another. He was not withdrawing as long as the president preferred him. On Thursday, the 13th, Wallace met for lunch with Roosevelt, who reported the meeting of the night of the 11th in some detail, explaining the preference of the professional politicians for Truman as the only one who had no enemies and might add a little independent strength to the ticket. Wallace showed him a new Gallup poll reporting 65% of Democratic voters in favor of Wallace, while Burns had but 3%, Truman 2%. The only other potential candidate with even a modest showing was Alvin Barkley, with 17%. It was his intention, Roosevelt said, to send a letter to the chairman of the convention, Senator Samuel Jackson, saying that if he were a delegate, he would vote for Wallace. Would he offer any alternative name, Wallace asked? No, Roosevelt assured him, he would not. The vice president stood to leave. At 55, he was slim and fit, a man who was regularly out of bed at 5:30 in the morning to play tennis. Yet he had an untidy look, which, with his underlying shyness and the shock of reddish-gray hair that hung over the right side of his forehead, made him seem almost rustic, and so entirely different from the seated president. "Well, I am looking ahead with pleasure to the results of next week, no matter what the outcome," Wallace said. Roosevelt, his head up, beaming, drew Wallace close and with a vigorous hand clasp said, "While I cannot put it just that way in public, I hope it will be the same old team." In another exchange earlier that same morning, Roosevelt had told Jimmy Burns he was certain Wallace could not win at Chicago, but that he would endorse no candidate other than Wallace. Burns pointed out that he had not allowed himself to become seriously interested until Bob Hannigan had told him, in effect, that he was the president's first choice. On the question of his standing with black voters, Burns said only that he didn't think that would matter when all was said and done. He showed the president a photograph he had just received from Aiken, South Carolina, in which Mrs. Roosevelt was seen addressing a group of blacks. "Look at the expressions on their faces," Burns said. "That is idolatry. You can't tell me that because you have a Southerner on the ticket that those people are going to turn against Mrs. Roosevelt and the president who have done more for them than anybody?" Roosevelt said he thought Burns was right. "Mr. President, all I have heard around this White House for the last week is Negro. I wonder if anybody ever thinks about the white people. Did you ever stop to think who would do the most for the Negro? This is a serious problem, but it will have to be solved by the white people of the South." He wanted an open convention, Roosevelt said, which Burns, understandably, took to mean that he himself had every chance for the nomination. "You are the best qualified man in the whole outfit, and you must not get out of the race," Roosevelt told him. "If you stay in, you are sure to win." Meeting with Hannigan and Frank Walker for lunch the next day, Burns repeated what Roosevelt had said. Hannigan was incredulous. "I don't understand it," he said. Neither did Burns, who, determined to settle the matter, returned to his White House office and put through a call to Roosevelt, who by this time was at his home in Hyde Park, New York. Burns, who had once been a court stenographer, took down their conversation in shorthand. Roosevelt said again he was not favoring anybody. "I told them so. No, I am not favoring anybody."
Burns.
Bob Hannigan and Frank Walker stated today that if at the convention they were asked about your views, they would be obliged to say to their friends that from your statements they concluded you did not prefer Wallace, but did prefer Truman first and Douglas second, and that either would be preferable to me because they would cost the ticket fewer votes than I would.
Roosevelt.
Jimmy, that is all wrong. That is not what I told them. It is what they told me. When we all went over the list, I did not say I preferred anybody or that anybody would cost me votes. But they all agreed that Truman would cost fewer votes than anybody and probably Douglas second. This was the agreement they reached, and I had nothing to do with it.
Burns pressed him. If Hannigan and his friends were to release any kind of statement saying the president preferred Truman and Douglas, that could make things very difficult for his own case.
"We have to be damn careful about language," Roosevelt answered. "They asked me if I would object to Truman and Douglas, and I said no. That is different from using the word prefer. That is not expressing a preference, because you know I told you I would have no preference."
Roosevelt asked Burns whether he would try for the nomination. Burns said he was considering it, but he needed to know the president's views. Roosevelt replied,
"After all, Jimmy, you are close to me personally, and Henry is close to me. I hardly know Truman. Douglas is a poker player. He is good in a poker game and tells good stories."
Finishing the call, Burns went directly down the corridor to Hopkins's office and repeated what the president had said. If anyone knew Roosevelt's mind, supposedly it was Hopkins, who now told Burns the president was sure that if Burns entered the race he would win, he would be nominated. According to Burns, it was then that he phoned Harry Truman in Missouri. Though Truman would remember the call coming early in the morning as he was about to leave for Chicago. Whether this was Friday morning or Saturday morning is not clear, nor important. But presumably, Burns would not have called Truman until after he had talked with the president, so most likely it was Saturday morning. Truman was staying at the President Hotel in Kansas City. Bess, Margaret, and Madge Wallace were visiting Fred Wallace at his new home in Denver. Burns asked if Truman was serious when he told the newspapers he did not want the vice presidential nomination. "Yes," Truman replied, "absolutely. He was not a candidate." Burns said he had been given the go sign from Roosevelt and would like nothing better than to have Truman make the nominating speech for him at Chicago. Truman accepted at once, saying he would be delighted and would do all he could to line up the Missouri delegation. Clearly, he too was convinced by this time that Burns was both the president's choice and the best one, and his source for such confidence must have been Bob Hannigan. Otherwise, he would never have responded so affirmatively and without hesitation. Again, by Truman's recollection, he had no sooner put down the phone than it rang a second time. Alban Barkley now wanted him to make his nominating speech at Chicago. He was sorry, Truman replied, but he had just said yes to Jimmy Burns. Section 2. The turmoil at the Chicago Convention was entirely over the vice presidency, and at no time did the outcome appear inevitable. Ambitions were too large, the opportunities for deceit and maneuver and the play of emotion too plentiful, the dictates of Franklin Roosevelt too capricious and uncertain for there to have been even a momentary sense of events moving as if on a track.
things could have gone differently at any of several points and with the most far-reaching consequences. As Alban Barkley would write, the denouement in Chicago of all the plotting that had gone on in Washington was a fascinating political drama. It was politics for the highest stakes, politics at its slipperiest, and the only real drama of either national convention that summer. A few weeks before, when the Republicans filled the same hotels and picked their nominees in the same steaming hall, there had been no contest and no surprises. Thomas E. Dewey was smoothly nominated on the first ballot, and his only near rival, Senator John W. Bricker, was the choice for running mate. Now the assembling Democrats were to be denied the chance even to see their standard-bearer, their hero, whose overwhelming endorsement for yet another term was a foregone conclusion. Roosevelt had declined to appear before the convention because of his duties as commander-in-chief, he said, just as he had agreed to run again because he saw it as his duty as a good soldier in time of war. His acceptance speech was to be delivered by radio hookup from some undisclosed location on the West Coast. But as so many of the Democrats who converged on Chicago understood, the task of choosing a vice president had unique importance this time. The common, realistic, and not unspoken view was that they were there to pick not one but two presidents. And if the identity of the first was clear, that of the second was not. Had there been a poll of the delegates as they checked in at the hotels, the choice of the majority would have been Henry Wallace. I.F. Stone, writing in The Nation, said that on the basis of his inside sources, he could report for certain it would be Wallace. Yet the eminent radio commentator, H.V. Kaltenborn, virtually announced the nomination of Alban Barkley, while Arthur Crock of the New York Times said the prime contenders after Wallace were Burns, Barkley, and Douglas in that order, and made no mention of Harry Truman. Speaking for the Democratic National Committee, George Allen thought it would be Truman, but he couldn't be sure. Hannigan and Mayor Kelly, meantime, two of the most powerful figures on the committee, had concluded it would be Burns. But, of course, nobody really knew, since so much depended on Franklin Roosevelt, and, as George Allen also aptly observed, Roosevelt could, of course, have named anybody. Privately, and as he would tell no one until much later, Truman thought it would be Wallace. Looking back on what happened, Alban Barkley would conclude that he had been sadly naive about the whole business. He had been in politics nearly 40 years. This was his 11th national convention. But he had never seen anything like what went on. Truman drove to Chicago from Kansas City on Saturday, July 15th, 4 days before the convention was officially to open, and the same day the president's westbound train made an unscheduled stop at Chicago. As later disclosed, Roosevelt was en route to San Diego, where a cruiser would take him to Hawaii for meetings with General Douglas MacArthur. But at 3 that afternoon, his train was shunted onto a siding so that Bob Hannigan could come aboard for a private talk in the president's new armor-plated private railroad car, the Ferdinand Magellan, another innovation resulting from the war. They were together approximately half an hour. The train stood in the Chicago yards during this conference, and none of us showed ourselves outside, wrote the president's secretary, Grace Tully. Though nearly everything said between Roosevelt and Hannigan was kept secret, one request by Roosevelt would become the best-known line of the convention. Whatever was decided, said the president, Hannigan must first clear it with Sidney, meaning that Sidney Hillman was to have the final say. Hillman, who now ran the CIO's Well-Heeled Political Action Committee, or PAC, which was something new in American politics. Hannigan also came off the train with a letter on White House stationery, which, in lieu of a briefcase, he carried inside a copy of the National Geographic magazine. The letter was post-dated July 19th. "Dear Bob, you have written me about Harry Truman and Bill Douglas. I should, of course, be very glad to run with either of them, and believe that either one of them would bring real strength to the ticket. Always sincerely, Franklin Roosevelt." Whether it had been written earlier in Washington or was produced to order that day is not certain. Grace Tully, however, said Hannigan had come out of the president's sitting room with a letter in his hand naming two acceptable running mates. William O. Douglas first, Harry Truman second. And that Hannigan told her the president wanted it retyped with the order of the names reversed. To her, the reason for the switch seemed obvious. By naming Truman first, it plainly implied that he was the preferred choice of the president. Hannigan would later deny making any such switch. And since the first copy of the letter was thrown away by another secretary who did the actual typing, there was no way to confirm or disprove the story. Ed Pauley, who claimed to have been with Hannigan when he went to see Roosevelt, said later that Hannigan was back at his hotel before he discovered to his horror that Douglas was even mentioned. Also, a note dated July 19th in Roosevelt's hand, as well as a typewritten duplicate on White House stationery, have survived with Truman's name listed first. But Grace Tully was not known for fabricating stories, nor was there any reason why she should have done so in this instance. In any event, the handsome, gregarious Hannigan, Mr. Busyman Bob, as he would be remembered, was playing an extremely deceitful game at this, his first national convention, possibly at Roosevelt's direction, and possibly not. For his next move was to call Jimmy Burns in Washington, a second call to Burns that day. The first, made by Mayor Ed Kelly in the morning, had been to tell Burns that he, Kelly, and Hannigan were no longer worried about losing the Negro vote if Burns were on the ticket, and that this was the message Hannigan would take to Roosevelt when the presidential train came in. Now, in the second call, Hannigan told Burns that the vice presidency was all set. Burns was the one. "The president has given us the green light to support you, and he wants you in Chicago." Burns left Washington for Chicago at once, and seeing Tom Connally on the train, confided triumphantly that the nomination was his. Roosevelt himself had passed the word. "Harry Truman will nominate me," Burns said. Arriving in Chicago the morning of Sunday the 16th, Burns found a bright red fire chief's car and driver waiting at the station for him, courtesy of Mayor Kelly. He was taken directly to the mayor's apartment on Lakeshore Drive for a breakfast meeting with Kelly and Hannigan, who assured him he was the chosen man. "Well, you know Jimmy has been my choice from the very first. Go ahead and nominate him," they quoted Roosevelt as having instructed. A little afterward, Albin Barkley, too, was told by Kelly that it was in the bag for Jimmy. Hannigan and company spent most of the day with Burns mapping out strategy. Hannigan even ordered Roosevelt and Burns placards printed. By late afternoon, the word had spread among the delegates and reporters milling about in the hotel lobbies. The Roosevelt letter to Hannigan was kept secret. Hannigan was showing it to no one because of its mention of Douglas, he later said. And no one apparently had said anything about it as yet to Senator Truman, who by now had his nominating speech for Burns all prepared. Sitting beside an open window in his hotel room that evening, the flat, gray-blue panorama of Lake Michigan in the distance, Truman talked at length to a St. Louis reporter, with the understanding that most of what he said was off the record. Although Bess and Margaret, due to arrive from Denver on Tuesday, would be staying at the Morrison Hotel, the senator had taken a suite in the Stevens across the street from the venerable Blackstone so that his politicking wouldn't disturb their sleep. Jimmy Burns, his candidate, was also in the Stevens, six flights up on the 23rd floor, in the hotel's plush Royal Skyway, the same rooms occupied a few weeks earlier by Thomas E. Dewey. He was determined to stay out of the running, Truman said. He knew his Pendergast background would be dragged out again, and he wished none of that. He had worked too hard to build a good name in the Senate. The reporter remarked that, as vice president, he might succeed to the throne. Truman shook his head. Hell, I don't want to be president. He then described the failures and scorn experienced by every vice president who had succeeded to the highest office, beginning with John Tyler and, overlooking the most obvious example to the contrary, Theodore Roosevelt. To another reporter that same evening, Truman repeated much the same thing. Those who had succeeded dead presidents were ridiculed in office, had their hearts broken, and lost any vestige of respect they had before. I don't want that to happen to me. Nobody, it would seem, was avoiding the central issue of Roosevelt's health and what the vice presidential nomination really meant. Truman's Kansas City friend Tom Evans later said Truman knew perfectly well that Roosevelt's days were numbered, and this was precisely why he had no desire to be on the ticket. I'm satisfied with where I am, Evans remembered him saying. Just a heartbeat. This little, said Truman, making a tiny space between forefinger and thumb, separates the vice president and the president. Since arriving in Chicago, he had hardly been able to sleep at night. He hated the thought of intrusions on his family's privacy, and what so much notoriety might do to Margaret at such an important stage in her life. He was worried about skeletons in the closet, he told Evans, about Bess being on the office payroll in Washington, and what the papers would make of that. Writing years later, Margaret would say that most of all he feared what a disclosure and retelling of David Wallace's suicide would do to Bess and her mother. Evans, an old Pendergast loyalist who had grown rich with a chain of drugstores that also sold quantities of Pendergast beer and whiskey, had come to Chicago at Truman's request for the supposed purpose of helping him fend off the nomination, as had Eddie McKim and John Snyder. Scowling, heavy-handed Fred Canfield, too, was on hand in his role as general factotum, and looking, noted one reporter, as if he could throw a bull in two falls out of three. Canfield would later complain of missing much of the drama on the convention floor because somebody else wanted some booze and I had to help him. Yet they all seemed to have spent most of their time talking Truman up as the ideal choice, McKim liked to say it was a question of destiny, and trying to persuade Truman to change his mind. Roy Roberts, the fat, hard-drinking, opinionated editor of the Kansas City Star, who was a Republican and a man Truman loathed, also came and went, perspiring heavily and acting like a kingmaker, which aggravated Truman greatly. None of them lost sight of the point that it was really the presidency at stake. As McKim remembered, they got Truman in a room and explained the situation to him. After much talk, McKim told him, "I think, Senator, that you're going to do it." "What gave him that idea?" Truman snapped. "Because," said McKim, "there's a little old 90-year-old mother down in Grandview, Missouri, that would like to see her son president of the United States." Truman, in tears, stomped out of the room. Bess, Margaret, Mildred Dryden, his little band of Missouri friends, as well as his brother Vivian, who was in Chicago to see his first national convention, were all sure he did not want the nomination, and would all later stress how extremely stubborn he grew as pressures on him increased. Only Vic Messall, who was still out of favor but on hand as a spectator, thought differently. Truman was always politically ambitious, Messall said. I'm sure he wanted to be vice president, but he had to pretend he didn't. Reflecting on Truman's frame of mind years later, John Snyder would say that it wasn't so much that Truman didn't want to be president, but that he didn't want to succeed Franklin Roosevelt, which was different. For Truman, in memory, the convention would always be that miserable time in Chicago, the most exasperating experience of his life. Marquis Childs, a practiced Truman observer, described him as plainly scared to death. The sensation of Monday, July 17th, was the release by Convention Chairman Samuel Jackson of Roosevelt's letter about Wallace. 100 reporters or more fought for the mimeographed copies. It had been written at Hyde Park on Friday, the same day as Roosevelt's reassuring telephone conversation with Jimmy Burns. I have been associated with Henry Wallace during his past 4 years as vice president, read the key paragraph of the instantly famous document. For 8 years earlier, while he was Secretary of Agriculture, and well before that. I like him, and I respect him, and he is my personal friend. For these reasons, I personally would vote for his nomination if I were a delegate to the convention. To many, it seemed a kiss of death for Wallace. The coolest and cruelest brush-off in all the long Roosevelt career, in the words of one account. Unquestionably, it threw the choice of a running mate wide open. He did not wish to appear to be in any way dictating to the convention, Roosevelt had also written. If anybody benefited, said several papers, it was Jimmy Burns. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch called the letter a spur to the already soaring campaign stock of energetic little Jimmy Burns. But the Wallace forces, including Sidney Hillman and Phil Murray of the CIO, took the announcement as a sign of hope, since theirs were the only candidate who now had something in writing from the president. It was generally regarded as a Roosevelt endorsement, remembered Senator Claude Pepper of Florida, a Wallace floor leader, who from his conversations with Roosevelt in Washington was certain Roosevelt wanted Wallace. It was only now, in response, that Hannigan began saying he too had a letter from the president, which named Truman, but no one was allowed to see it. Hannigan's corner suite on the 7th floor of the Blackstone, rooms 708 and 709, had become the convention nerve center, since Hannigan alone claimed direct telephone contact with the president. In the red-carpeted hall outside, reporters and photographers set up a round-the-clock vigil to see who came and went. At first, Hannigan tried to discourage them, insisting that nothing was happening there. Mayor Kelly, who was in and out continually, kept mentioning the Roosevelt letter. "Do you want to see it?" he asked a skeptical representative of the United Auto Workers. "Indeed, yes," said the man. "I haven't got it with me," Kelly replied, "but I'll show it to you tomorrow." At a dinner that night arranged by Kelly in a private apartment on Chicago's north side, a location kept secret from the press, Burns was man of the hour. It was only when everybody was about to leave that Hannigan mentioned one further detail: the need, as required by the president, to clear it with Sidney, a point Hannigan seemed to regard as only a formality. On Tuesday morning, Senator Truman and Sidney Hillman had orange juice, eggs, and bacon sent up by room service to Hillman's suite at the Ambassador East, the fancy hotel, as Truman called it. Born in Lithuania, educated to be a rabbi, Hillman had been an $8-a-week apprentice pants cutter in the garment district of New York when Truman was still riding a plow on the farm. He had led his first strike at 23 and founded the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America by the time he was 30. He had also joined the Socialist Party and still spoke with a slight accent, which would have been more than enough in places like Grandview, Missouri, to have made him seem a dangerous radical. To party chiefs like Hannigan and Kelly, he was an amateur, and therefore not wholly trustworthy, whatever the power of his pack or his allegiance to the president. Hillman wasn't even a registered Democrat. In addition, as co-director of the former Office of Production Management in Washington, he had come under heavy fire from the Truman Committee, which had been mainly responsible for his removal. And so Truman had no reason to expect much from him in the way of cooperation or favors. Truman asked for Hillman's support for Burns. Hillman declined and refused to be budged. He was working hard for Henry Wallace, Hillman said. If it could not be Wallace, then he wanted either William O. Douglas or Harry Truman. Truman said he was going to nominate Burns. Hillman said that would be a mistake. Truman reported directly to Burns all that Hillman had said, but Burns seemed not to care, and with reason. By reliable reports, he had already lined up more than 400 of the 589 votes needed to nominate. When Ed Flynn arrived in Chicago later that morning, Tuesday the 18th, Hannigan rushed him into a corner to say it was all over. "It's Burns." Flynn said it was no such thing and demanded a meeting of the Select Committee, the same group as the night before, which convened again in the same secret North Side apartment, except that this time Sidney Hillman was included and Jimmy Burns was not. There was only one man to nominate, Flynn insisted, and that was Harry Truman, because Harry Truman was what they had agreed to with the president. Flynn was extremely angry. "I browbeat the committee. I talked, I argued, I swore," he later wrote. Hillman declared Burns unacceptable to organized labor. Flynn said Burns would cost no less than 200,000 Negro votes in New York alone. Burns was a political liability. Roosevelt could lose the election. Everyone agreed. Hannigan, the party's chairman, Pauley, Walker, Allen, Hillman for labor, Kelly, the big city boss. Reporters were to call them the Harmony Boys. Flynn put through a call to Roosevelt in San Diego, and one by one, each man got on the line. In the end, Roosevelt agreed it should be Truman. Though accounts differ somewhat, this appears to be what happened next. Within a short time that evening, Burns and Truman were individually told what the president had said. Truman heard it from Hannigan, who came to his room at the Stevens, and also showed him a longhand note from the president saying, as Truman remembered, "Bob, it's Truman, FDR." A different wording from what Roosevelt had supposedly scrawled for Hannigan on the night of the 11th at the White House. Also, by Truman's recollection, the note he was now shown was written on scratch paper, not an envelope. Truman doubted Roosevelt had written it. I still could not be sure this was Roosevelt's intent, he would recall. An hour or so later, Truman went alone to the Royal Skyway to square things with Burns. He asked to be released from his promise of support. Burns said he understood perfectly, given the circumstances. Whether he would stay in the race, Burns said, was a question he would have to sleep on. When Burns tried to get through to Roosevelt by phone, he was told the president was unavailable. Word of the sudden turn in events spread fast. Ed Flynn had been in town less than a day, and everything had changed. In a long account by Turner Catledge in the New York Times the next morning, Wednesday, July 19th, opening day for the convention, was a revealing paragraph. Reports that Senator Truman was to be the choice of the anti-Wallace forces were heard in the New York State delegation. Edward J. Flynn, New York National Committeeman, in a conference with leaders, informed them that the decision of the Wallace opponents was to back Senator Truman, and that the New York delegation might be voting for him, at least after the first ballot. The group agreed to accede to this decision. Burns dropped out of the race, and the talk everywhere was that the bosses killed his candidacy. In a release to the press, Burns said he was withdrawing in deference to the wishes of the president. He then left for home in a fury, feeling he had been betrayed by Roosevelt. In a parting conversation with Alban Barkley, who was scheduled to nominate the president, Burns remarked sourly, "If I were you, I wouldn't say anything too complimentary about him." Barkley was as upset as Burns, furious over Roosevelt and his games at their expense. He was sick and tired of trying to determine which shell the pea was under, Barkley told a reporter, and threatened to tear up his nominating speech and be done with the whole affair. For Truman, events were out of hand. These were three or four of the most critical days of his life, and they were beyond his control, his destiny being decided for him by others once again. Speculation now centered on him. But as his stock rose, so did objections to him, because of the Pendergast connection. Jim Pendergast was prominent in the Missouri delegation, which was the first to name Truman its choice for vice president, quite against his wishes. Running into his old high school classmate, Charlie Ross, now a contributing editor for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Truman said, "Feel sorry for me. I'm in a terrible fix." How much faith he had in Hannigan at this point, he never said. But to many, it looked as though the young party head was out of line in taking such an overtly partisan role. He appeared to be constantly improvising, seldom sure of his ground. To prove he really did have something in writing from Roosevelt about Truman, he at last released the much-talked-of letter. But this only produced more grumbling and controversy. Why hadn't he said it mentioned Truman and Douglas? His claim of an endorsement for Truman was only half true, and wasn't a half-truth as good as a lie? And how much credence should be given to a letter released on July 18th that was supposedly written on July 19th? Among those most surprised by the letter when he later saw accounts of it in the papers was William O. Douglas, who at the time of the convention was in Oregon hiking in the mountains. No one had told him he was being considered. Meantime, Henry Wallace had arrived in Chicago, and at a packed press conference at the Sherman Hotel, sitting on a table with his long legs swinging, Wallace said he was there to fight to the finish. His supporters were claiming 400 votes on the first ballot. In a secret caucus of the Political Action Committee at the Sherman, CIO President Phil Murray shook his fist and said in his deep Scottish burr, "Wallace, Wallace, Wallace, that's it. Just keep pounding." A sluggish, entirely routine first session of the convention opened just before noon inside Chicago Stadium, the same giant arena where Roosevelt had been nominated in 1932 and again in 1940. From steel girders overhead hung a huge Roosevelt portrait used in 1940, only retouched a little to make him look a bit less pale. There was a prayer. There were speeches. The real business continued at the hotels. Section 3. Only narrow Balbo Street separated the Stevens from the Blackstone. And it was to the Blackstone, to Hannigan's seventh-floor suite, that Truman was summoned that afternoon, Wednesday, July 19th. Hannigan, collar open, his shirt damp with perspiration, had assembled the inner core, Pauly, Walker, Kelly, Flynn, plus, for the first time, boss Frank Haig of Jersey City, who had never cared particularly for Senator Truman, and who, until now, had been telling delegates that he didn't want Truman because his nomination would only stir up the whole boss issue. It was clearly a gathering arranged for effect, for Truman's benefit. Barclay would later refer to Hannigan as the stage manager at Chicago. The time had come for a decision from the senator. They were placing a call to San Diego. Truman sat on one twin bed. Hannigan, phone in hand, sat on the other. Whenever Roosevelt used the telephone, Truman remembered, he always talked in such a strong voice that it was necessary for the listener to hold the receiver away from his ear to avoid being deafened. So I found it possible to hear both ends of the conversation. Bob, Roosevelt's voice boomed, have you got that fellow lined up yet? No, said Hannigan. He is the contrariest goddamn mule from Missouri I ever dealt with. Well, you tell the senator that if he wants to break up the Democratic Party in the middle of the war, that's his responsibility. With that, Roosevelt banged down the phone. Truman said later that he was completely stunned. I was floored. I was sunk. Reportedly, his first words were, oh, shit. He himself recalled saying, well, if that's the situation, I'll have to say yes. But why the hell didn't he tell me in the first place? That evening, Henry Wallace made a surprise appearance on the floor of the convention, and the roar of approval from the galleries astonished everyone, including, noticeably, Henry Wallace. Ye gods, wrote Margaret Truman in her diary, the Missouri delegation has decided to nominate Dad for VP. Vice President Wallace is very strong, so I doubt if we win, although the South doesn't want Wallace at all. To judge by her use of the word we, Bess, too, had resigned herself to the decision. On Thursday, July 20th, an immense crowd filling the hall, the convention became a thundering, old-fashioned political circus. Albin Barclay, bathed in spotlights on the podium, his broad face streaming with perspiration, his anger at Roosevelt forgotten for the moment, delivered a fulsome tribute to the great leader that set off a demonstration lasting 40 minutes. In seconding the nomination, Henry Wallace gave one of the strongest speeches of his career, an impassioned, straight-from-the-shoulder declaration of liberal principles that brought the huge, roaring audience to its feet time after time. The only chance for the Democratic Party, he said, was to keep on its liberal course. In a political, educational, and economic sense, there must be no inferior races. The poll tax must go. Educational opportunities must come. The future must bring equal wages for equal work regardless of sex or race. By evening, As time for the president's address approached, the crowd had grown far beyond what the arena was built to hold. It was packed to the roof with perhaps 40,000 people. Reportedly, 15,000 counterfeit tickets had been printed and distributed with the blessing of Mayor Kelly, who, for all his apparent Truman fervor, was secretly hoping for a Truman-Wallace deadlock, so the prize would go to his own candidate, Illinois' favorite son, Senator Scott Lucas. But the ticket ploy resulted in thousands of additional Wallace supporters, many supplied by the CIO, who jammed the galleries and worked their way onto the convention floor while thousands more milled about in the corridors. The Wallace people were determined to see the nomination decided there in the hall and not by the big boys in a smoke-filled room. The idea was to stampede the convention. Nominations for the vice presidency were scheduled for the next day. But as the evening wore on, with more speeches and fanfare for Roosevelt, the surge for Wallace kept growing. The heat inside the hall was nearly unbearable. At the Blackstone, Hannigan told Truman he might have to be nominated that night, depending whether they had the votes. They would have to be ready to move fast. Bennett Clark was supposed to nominate Truman, but no one knew where he was. Clark, whose wife had died the year before, had been drinking more than usual. Truman went to look for him. Hannigan started for the convention hall. When the speeches and roll call ended, and the president was swiftly renominated, the delegates settled down to hear his speech. The familiar voice came booming from a cluster of amplifiers as the huge crowd sat watching the empty podium. Absolute silence hung over the darkened hall, even during the president's pauses. With no one on stage, the effect was eerie. Roosevelt was speaking from his railroad car in San Diego. "What is the job before us in 1944? The great disembodied voice asked. "First, to win the war. To win the war fast, to win it overpoweringly. Second, to form worldwide international organizations and to arrange to use the armed forces of the sovereign nations of the world to make another war impossible." No sooner was the speech over than a Wallace demonstration erupted. From every corner of the stadium came a chant of, "We want Wallace." The organist, catching the spirit, began pumping away at the Wallace theme song. "Iowa, Iowa, that's where the tall corn grows," over and over. Ed Pauley, livid with rage, threatened to chop the wires to the amplifiers, unless the tune was changed. Bob Hannigan was seen hurriedly conferring with Mayor Kelly in the Illinois delegation. Then they were both up on the podium, heads together with Chairman Jackson. To several of the Wallace floor leaders, it looked suddenly as if the time to nominate their man was then, that night, and the quicker the better. "I sat there and watched the demonstration, and I saw it growing in volume," remembered Claude Pepper, who, as head of the Florida delegation, was positioned on the aisle. "I stood up on my seat, and I could see the whole convention hall then. And I said to myself, you know, that's a real demonstration. So after it got into full speed and steam, I said, if we could bring this nomination up right now, we could nominate Henry Wallace." At the rear of the hall now, Hannigan had started throwing open the outer doors to let more people in, while, at the same time, Ed Kelly kept shouting about fire rules. Desperate to get the chairman's eye, Pepper tried hopping up and down on his chair, waving the Florida banner, but to no avail. His floor microphone had been turned off. He jumped down and started up the aisle, fighting his way through the crowd. Reporters, hundreds of delegates and spectators saw him and knew at once what he was trying to do. If he could get to the podium, he would make the nominating speech himself with no more delay.
"And then when I got to the little gate," remembered Pepper, "the little fence around the podium where the chairman presided, well, fortunately there was a railroad labor man that was minding the gate. He was a friend of mine, so he opened the gate and let me in. I got up to about the second step from the top, going just as hard as I could to get up that stairway, and I saw the chairman look over there. He had seen me coming up the aisle. And so immediately, by this time I got about nearly to the first step, the chairman said, 'Motion made, the convention adjourned. All in favor of the motion, let me know by saying aye, aye.' And that's it. And the convention's adjourned. And I by that time was just about to the top step, and they started roaring, 'No, no, no, no.'"
Jackson later told Pepper he had hated to do what he did, but that he had promised the newspaper and radio people to hold the vice presidential decision until the next day when they would be better prepared. Jackson admitted he had seen Pepper trying to get his attention, that he had an eye on him the whole time he was heading for the podium, and knew perfectly well why he was coming. What he did not tell Pepper was that he and Bob Hannigan had already made an agreement to shut things down that night before the Wallace people could start the nominations. The public explanation was that the decision was a matter of necessity because of fire laws. Harry Truman had witnessed none of this. He had spent the night in search of Bennett Clark, finding him finally in a room where he was not supposed to be, at the Sherman, and too drunk to say much more than hello. By then, it was past midnight. "So I called Bob Hannigan," Truman remembered, "and said, 'I found your boy. He's cockeyed. I don't know whether I can get him ready or not, and I hope to Christ I can't.'" Of all those in Missouri who had kept track of Harry Truman's activities and accomplishments in the Senate over the past 9 years, none had been so attentive, appraising his every move, as his mother, Martha Ellen Truman, who remained a close reader of the congressional record and a more partisan Democrat than almost anyone he knew. Once introducing her to a political friend, Truman told her the man had grown up in Mississippi and had never seen a Republican until he was 12. "He didn't miss much," she replied. For days now, in her small parlor at Grandview, she had been sitting close to the radio following the convention. Interviewed by reporters, she said she did not want her son to become vice president. "He should stay in the Senate," she said emphatically.
"I listened to all the Republican convention, too. They kept predicting that Roosevelt will die in office if he's elected. The Republicans hope he will. They keep saying that I'll die, too, and I'm almost 92. I hope Roosevelt fools them."
The final session inside the stadium, Friday, July 21st, lasted 9 hours and would be described as the strangest, most bitter conclusion to a national convention in a very long time. Senator Bennett Clark, after a great deal of black coffee, a shower, and some food, had, with Hannigan's help, pulled himself together sufficiently to appear on the podium. But his speech for Truman was short and had none of his usual flair. He moved the audience not at all. In another few weeks, as Truman had anticipated, Bennett Clark went down to defeat in the Democratic primary in Missouri, thereby ending a career in the Senate that many, including Truman, had once thought could lead to the White House. Nor were the seconding speakers much of an improvement. A labor leader from Pennsylvania said that while he did not know the senator personally, he thought Truman would make the strongest possible running mate for the reason that he was a Democrat and an American. By contrast, a vigorous speech for Henry Wallace, delivered by an Iowa judge named Richard Mitchell, touched off another noisy demonstration, and Claude Pepper, given a turn at the podium at last, made a moving plea to the Democratic Party not to repudiate the man who more than any other symbolized the democracy of Franklin Roosevelt. Wallace's delegate strength for the first ballot appeared to be gaining. But Hannigan, Flynn, Kelly, and the others had been working through the night, talking to delegates and applying a good deal of pressure to help them see the sense in selecting Harry Truman. No one knows how many deals were cut, how many ambassadorships or postmaster jobs were promised, but reportedly by the time morning came, Postmaster General Frank Walker had telephoned every chairman of every delegation. The strategy of the Truman forces was to organize as many favorite son nominations as possible and thereby keep Wallace from winning on the first ballot. The result was a total of 16 nominations for vice president, and as the speeches continued through the long afternoon, delegates in groups of twos and threes were seen going to and from a private air-conditioned room beneath the platform, Room H, at the end of a narrow, dark hall where, for hours, Senator Truman stood shaking hands. Only later did he emerge to join Bess and Margaret in a box just behind the podium. Henry Wallace was waiting out the session in his hotel room, in keeping with custom. But Truman sat in full view, munching on a hot dog and enjoying the spectacle. The nominating session had drawn some interesting visitors, including film stars Gloria Swanson, who occupied a box close by, and Spencer Tracy, who was besieged by autograph hunters. Among the delegates were 17 of Truman's fellow Democrats from the Senate. Ed Flynn and Frank Haig could be seen conferring on the platform, a tableau that caused some veteran observers among the press to recall earlier times when the big boys were more discreet about their conniving. But the crowds in the galleries were nothing like the night before. Mayor Kelly's police had been checking tickets, with the result that thousands of Wallace supporters had been kept out. The first ballot began at 4:30 p.m., and Wallace stayed in the lead the whole way, rolling up 429 votes to Truman's 319, with the remainder divided among Alban Barkley and the favorite sons. By the time the tally became official, it was past six. The convention had been in session for nearly 7 hours without pause, and the crowd expected to recess for dinner before the night session. But then Chairman Jackson stepped to the microphones to announce that a second ballot would be taken at once. The convention was still in its afternoon session, which meant no tickets for the night meeting would be honored, and therefore no more Wallace crowds admitted. It was a daring stroke by Hannigan. On the second ballot, the excitement began to build almost at once. Wallace was ahead until suddenly, just as had been forecast for the second ballot, Ed Flynn delivered to Truman 74 votes from the New York delegation, which had been divided the first time around. Now Truman moved out in front. For a moment, the count narrowed again, Wallace pulling to within 5 votes of Truman. Then the break came. Alabama's favorite son, Senator John Bankhead, withdrew his name and cast 22 Alabama votes for Truman, which gave Truman nearly 500. Delegates rose from their chairs. South Carolina switched 18 votes from Bankhead to Truman, and the stampede was on. Indiana, Wyoming, and Maine went over to Truman, while from the galleries came an insistent roar of, "We want Wallace!" Photographers were clustering about the Truman box. The senator was smiling broadly. Even Bess, who had looked intermittently grumpy and skeptical through the first ballot, was seen beaming now and turning as requested to pose with her husband. Margaret was jumping up and down, cheering as if at a college football game. Over in the Illinois delegation, Mayor Kelly shouted to Senator Lucas
Christ Almighty, let's get in this thing.
The whole crowd was on its feet. Truman only needed one big state. Ohio announced for Truman, which would have been enough, but a delegate challenged the count, and Ohio passed. Then Senator David I. Walsh of Massachusetts declared that Massachusetts changed its vote to 34 for Truman, and that did it. Senator Harry S. Truman of Missouri, unofficially but conclusively, was the party's nominee for vice president. Illinois, a little late, piled on another 55 votes for Truman, and more states followed. Bennett Clark started a Truman procession down the aisles as a phalanx of police escorted the nominee to the platform. The official tally was running late, but at 8:14, Chairman Jackson formally announced the Truman victory. The final count was Truman, 1,031, Wallace, 105. William O. Douglas had 4 votes. The acceptance speech, one of the shortest in American political history, lasted less than a minute. The nomination was an honor for Missouri, Truman said, and an honor that he accepted with all humility. More than the speech, it was the shy, almost embarrassed way he stepped up to the bank of microphones and the way he stood waiting for the crowd to settle down that many people would remember. He looked out at the huge hall in tumult, his glasses glinting in the spotlight. Then he stepped back slightly. "Now, give me a chance," he said. He was called the Missouri Compromise and the common denominator of the convention. To many, it had all been a sad spectacle. "I don't object to Truman," wrote Harold Ickes to Bernard Baruch, "but I react strongly against the method of his nomination and the seeming dominating position that the corrupt city bosses now have in the Democratic National Organization." The senator's Pendergast roots figured in editorials across the country. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette called him one of the weakest candidates ever nominated. Time magazine, which only the summer before had lauded his work on the Truman Committee, portrayed him now as a drab mediocrity. The mousy little man from Missouri. "Poor Harry Truman and poor people of the United States," wrote Richard Strout in The New Republic. "Truman and the people are the ones who will suffer from that convention deal between Roosevelt and the bosses. Truman is a nice man, an honest man, a good senator, a man of great humility and a man of courage. He will make a passable vice president. But Truman as president of the United States in times like these?" Yet, on balance, the reaction was favorable, if not enthusiastic. "For all his machine background," said the Kansas City Star, "Harry Truman had unusual capacity for development." The New York Times praised his personal qualities and said he had the advantage of having been through the political mill. "He has known the dust and heat of a political campaign, and has learned the art, not to be despised, of seeking that middle course which will appeal to a majority of the voters. He fought with distinction in the First World War. He has been a farmer. He has known firsthand the difficulties of a small businessman. He has had the kind of experience, in short, likely to make a realist sympathetic to the problems of the varied groups, rather than to produce the doctrinaire or the zealot." Astonishingly, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch called him an excellent choice. Even Richard Strout, in his otherwise gloomy New Republic essay, took heart from the idea that Truman, while not brilliant, had character. Reflecting on the nomination in the privacy of his diary, reporter Alan Drury wrote, "On the credit side, the senator is a fine man. No one would do a better job of it in the White House if he had to. On the other side, the Pendergast background made him entirely too vulnerable to Republican attack, and no one who knows him likes to see him subjected to that kind of smearing. I think Senator Truman is one of the finest men I know. Again, at Chicago, as so consistently through the Truman career, it had been the system of politics, the boss system, that counted in deciding his fate. There had been no popular boom for him for vice president, nor had personal ambition figured. As Richard Rovere wrote, no one ever contrived less at his own elevation than Harry Truman at Chicago. And as time would tell, everything considered, the system, bosses and all, had produced an excellent choice. In Independence a few days later, 3,000 people streamed across the back lawn at 219 North Delaware to shake hands with the senator, who, in a white seersucker suit, stood beneath a blooming rose arbor beside his wife and daughter. Bess was performing the expected public role, though far from happily. At Chicago, after the nomination, as they fought their way out through the crowds to a waiting limousine, with police pushing and shoving, she had turned and glared at her husband, demanding, "Are we going to have to go through this for the rest of our lives?" On the drive home through the smothering July heat of southern Illinois, the atmosphere inside their own car was, as Margaret recalled, close to Arctic. Dad tried to be cheerful and philosophical simultaneously. Mother said little. No sooner had they arrived in Independence than Margaret's aunt, Natalie Wallace, Uncle Frank's wife, took it upon herself to tell Margaret that her grandfather Wallace had shot himself. Margaret ought to know, she said, since the story was bound to come out any time now. Shattered, disbelieving, Margaret rushed to the kitchen to ask Vieta Garr if this were true. Vieta nodded. Unable to face her mother, Margaret waited until evening to tell her father what she had heard. And for the first and only time in her life he turned his fury on her. He seized my arm in a grip that he must have learned when he was wrestling calves and hogs around the farmyard, she remembered. "Don't you ever mention that to your mother," he said. Then Truman rocketed out the door to find Aunt Natalie. I wish I could tell you that years later I asked Mother if her anxiety about her father's death was the hidden reason for her opposition to Dad's nomination, Margaret would write years later. But to the end of her life I never felt free to violate the absolute prohibition Dad issued on that summer night in 1944. Out-of-town reporters, looking over the old gray Victorian house for the first time, saw that it needed paint. The defeated Henry Wallace immediately declared his all-out support for the ticket, exhibiting no bitterness, and in turn he was praised for his courage and forthrightness. Contrary to predictions, he had had real delegate strength after all, and had nearly carried the convention despite all the forces aligned against him. Roosevelt would have had no trouble whatever getting him nominated had he so decided. But then no one seemed nearer to understanding Roosevelt after the convention than before. Eleanor Roosevelt wrote sympathetically to Wallace, "I had hoped by some miracle you could win out, but it looks to me as though the bosses had functioned pretty smoothly. I am told that Senator Truman is a good man, and I hope so for the sake of the country." What was not perceived as yet, because so little was known of what went on behind the scenes at Chicago, as well as in Washington before the convention, was the critical part played by Ed Flynn. The fact that it was Flynn, more than anyone, who had convinced Roosevelt that Wallace was a liability and urged Harry Truman on him as the safest alternative. that it was Flynn, the day he arrived in Chicago, who refused to accept Jimmy Burns as a fait accompli, as Kelly and Hannigan had, that it was Flynn, with perfect timing on the second ballot, who delivered the important New York vote. Southern opposition to Wallace because of his views on racial equality was clear, as was the refusal of Northern liberals to accept the Southerner Burns for his opposing views on the same subject. What was not so clear, still, was the degree to which Flynn worried over the black vote in New York, the point he had stressed at the secret White House meetings in the spring. It was vital that Truman had no opposition from organized labor, as Burns did. It was important that Truman was seen by the conservative side of the party, the Southerners' side, as the kind of politician they could work with, who would go along in the old phrase, as Wallace never could. It was also very important that Truman had no enemies, that nearly everybody liked Harry Truman, and especially in the Senate, where there would be much work to do when the war was over and the Senate once again, as after the first war, would take part in establishing the peace. But given Ed Flynn's concern about the black vote, it was, after all, Truman's record on civil rights, his stand in the Senate against the poll tax, his Sedalia speech in 1940, his talk to black delegates at the 1940 convention, that made him the right man. A somewhat ironic turn for the son of unreconstructed Missouri lineage who would soon be accused of having once been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Roosevelt declared himself well pleased with the outcome and wired Truman his congratulations. Harry Hopkins, somewhat in contradiction to what he had told Jimmy Burns, said later that the president had had an eye on Truman all along. "People seemed to think that Truman was just suddenly pulled out of a hat, but that wasn't true," said Hopkins. Bernard Baruch said that while everyone professed a willingness to do what the boss, Roosevelt, wanted, the boss did what Ed Flynn wanted. Roosevelt's son Jimmy, a Marine officer who had been with him in San Diego at the time of the nomination, later wrote of his father's irritability over what was happening in Chicago, and of his apparent indifference as to whom the convention selected as a running mate. "Although Father did not commit himself, I came away with the distinct impression that he really preferred Justice William O. Douglas as the vice presidential nominee. But he professed not to give a damn whether the delegates came up with Justice Douglas, Jimmy Burns, or Harry Truman." On the very day of his renomination in Chicago, Roosevelt had had a seizure, as only his son Jimmy knew. He had suddenly turned deathly pale with a look of agony in his face. "Jimmy, I don't know if I can make it. I have horrible pains," Roosevelt said, barely able to get the words out. Jimmy helped him lie down on the floor of the railroad car and watched over him for about 10 minutes, terrified, until his father asked to be helped to his feet again. Soon afterward, the commander-in-chief was driven to a hilltop above the Pacific, where, chin up, smiling, intent, he watched 10,000 Marines storm ashore from Higgins boats in a dress rehearsal for an amphibious landing. Section 4. On Tuesday, August 18, 1944, in the shade of a magnolia tree said to have been planted by Andrew Jackson, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman had lunch on the south lawn of the White House. Because of the heat, Roosevelt suggested they take off their jackets. So it was in their shirt sleeves, seated at a small round table set with crystal and silver from the Coolidge years, that the two men posed together for photographers for the first time. In background, interests, personality, in everything from the sounds of their voices to the kind of company they enjoyed to the patterns of their careers, they could not have been much more dissimilar. Roosevelt was now in his 12th year in office. He had been president for so long and through such trying, stirring times that it seemed to many Americans, including the junior senator from Missouri, that he was virtually the presidency itself. His wealth, education, the social position he had known since childhood were everything Harry Truman never had. Life and customs at the Roosevelt family estate on the upper Hudson River were as far removed from Jackson County, Missouri, as some foreign land. Roosevelt fancied himself a farmer. To Truman, Roosevelt was the kind of farmer who had never pulled a weed, never known debt or crop failure, or a father's call to roll out of bed at 5:30 on a bitter cold morning. Truman, with his Monday night poker games, his Masonic ring and snappy bow ties, the Main Street pals, the dry Missouri voice, was entirely, undeniably middle American. He had only to open his mouth, and his origins were plain. It wasn't just that he came from a particular part of the country geographically, but from a specific part of the American experience, an authentic pioneer background, and a specific place in the American imagination. His Missouri, as he loved to emphasize, was the Missouri of Mark Twain and Jesse James. In manner and appearance, he might have stepped from a novel by Sinclair Lewis, an author Truman is not known to have read. To anyone taking him at face value, this might have been George F. Babbitt having lunch with the president under the Jackson Magnolia. Roosevelt, on the other hand, was from the world of Edith Wharton's stories and drawings by Charles Dana Gibson. He was the authentic American patrician come to power. No matter that he loved politics or a night of poker with the boys quite as much as the senator from Missouri, or that he, too, was a Mason, and chose a bow tie as many mornings as not, including this one. Roosevelt had been given things all of his life. Houses, furniture, servants, travels abroad. Truman had been given almost nothing. He had never had a house to call his own. He had been taught from childhood and by rough experience that what he became would depend almost entirely on what he did. Roosevelt had always known the possibilities open to him, indeed how much was expected of him, because of who he was. Both were men of exceptional determination, with great reserves of personal courage and cheerfulness. They were alike, too, in their enjoyment of people. The human race, Truman once told a reporter, was an excellent outfit. Each had an active sense of humor, and was inclined to be dubious of those who did not. But Roosevelt, who loved stories, loved also to laugh at his own, while Truman was more of a listener and laughed best when somebody else told a good one. Roosevelt enjoyed flattery. Truman was made uneasy by it. Roosevelt loved the subtleties of human relations. He was a master of the circuitous solution to problems, of the pleasing, if ambiguous, answer to difficult questions. He was sensitive to nuances in a way Harry Truman never was and never would be. Truman, with his rural Missouri background, and partly, too, because of the limits of his education, was inclined to see things in far simpler terms, as right or wrong, wise or foolish. He dealt little in abstractions. His answers to questions, even complicated questions, were nearly always direct and assured, plainly said, and followed often by a conclusive, "And that's all there is to it," an old Missouri expression, when in truth there may have been a great deal more to it. Each of them had been tested by his own painful struggle, Roosevelt with crippling polio, Truman with debt, failure, obscurity, and the heavy stigma of the Pendergasts. Roosevelt liked to quote the admonition of his old headmaster at Groton, Dr. Endicott Peabody. "Things in life will not always run smoothly. Sometimes we will be rising toward the heights. Then all will seem to reverse itself and start downward. The great fact to remember is that the trend of civilization is forever upward." Assuredly, Truman would have subscribed to the same vision. They were two optimists at heart, each in his way faithful to the old creed of human progress. But there had been nothing in Roosevelt's experience like the night young Harry held the lantern as his mother underwent surgery. Nothing like the Argonne, or Truman's desperate fight for political survival in 1940. Roosevelt, as would be said, was a kind of master conjurer. He had imagination. He was theatrical. If, as his cousins saw him, Harry Truman was Horatio, then Franklin Roosevelt was Prospero. Truman was often called a simple man, which he was not. "I wonder why we are made so that what we really think and feel we cover up," he had once confided to Bess. And some who knew him well would, in retrospect, feel he had withheld too much of himself from public view, and that this was among his greatest limitations. But in contrast to Franklin Roosevelt, and it was Truman's destiny from this point forward to be forever contrasted to Roosevelt, he was truly uncomplicated, open, and genuine. In private correspondence, Truman could be extremely revealing, whereas Roosevelt never dropped the mask, never poured his heart out on paper as did Truman in hundreds of letters and notes to himself, even after it was clear that he was to be a figure in history. To many Americans, Truman would always be the little man from Missouri. Roosevelt was larger than life, even in a wheelchair. He had that force of personality that Truman so admired in a leader, and to a degree rarely equaled in the ranks of the presidency. This, too, was something Truman knew he did not have himself, as he knew he had no exceptional intellectual prowess, as had, say, Henry Wallace. "I am not a deep thinker as you are," he had told Wallace only a day earlier, when asking Wallace for his help in the campaign ahead. Yet Truman, as Republican Congressman Joe Martin would write, was smarter by far than most people realized. In some ways, Truman would have felt more in common, more at ease, with the earlier Roosevelt, Theodore, had he been the host for the lunch. They were much more alike in temperament. They could have talked books, army life, or the boyhood handicap of having to meet the world wearing thick spectacles, or possibly the old fear of being thought a sissy. Like Theodore Roosevelt, and unlike Franklin, Truman had never